несколько слов о сегодняшнем расписании. Я уверена, что вы все посмотрели это расписание. Сегодня доктор Хекер продолжит свою презентацию. Он расскажет вам о сотрудничестве между российскими, советскими лабораториями ядерными, поскольку доктор Хекер директор Лос-Аламоса.
Mic is not working.
It's not working? Well, I need to hold something in my hand. Closer.
Like this. The mic is not working.
И мы будем работать в том же формате. 50 минут приблизительно, 10 минут перерыв, 50 минут, 10 минут перерыв. И этот модуль доктора Хекера будет продолжаться до 11.50, 12 часов. Потом у вас будет час на обед. В час к нам придет доктор Уильям Поттер. Он будет рассказывать о своем опыте работы и изучении сотрудничества между советскими учеными и российскими учеными в сфере нераспространения. Это будет короткая сессия, всего 1 час 15 минут, час презентация, 15 минут вопросы и ответы. Доктор Поттер работает здесь, поэтому, если вам будет интересна тема, мы устроим еще последующие презентации и встречи с вами. И в 2.25 посол Джек Мэтлок встретится с вами неформально, будет дискуссия на те вопросы, которые у вас есть. Спасибо большое, Джек, за то, что вы согласились на это время. Это будет до 4 часов. И в 6 часов перед вами будет выступать Брус Аллен и Синтия Лазаров и будут рассказывать вам о переговорных методологиях, стилях и так далее. Так что сегодня будет очень насыщенный день, и не буду больше ничего говорить сама и передам слово доктору Хекеру. Спасибо.
Спасибо большое. Доброе утро. Я не говорю по-русски, so I will do this in English. So good morning. Before I get into Russia, I have three Russian lectures for this morning. But before I get into that, I heard last night that Otawambia died. And you know what a tragedy, and my heart goes out for his family. And it also points out just how difficult these issues are that we talked about yesterday. So to some extent, sometimes you get so close, and then something like that happens, which is just obviously totally inexcusable. A young man with energy, with curiosity about the world, goes and visits a place, you know, that has risk, and then for taking a poster winds up losing his life. And that regime, the brutality of whatever happened and how it happened, you know, not to let him out early is just inexcusable. And, you know, I showed you yesterday at the end sort of my big hope, you know, that in the end there's still some hope with North Korea. And one can often point at our own government in the United States to say, we do such stupid things. So I got these ideas that I mentioned to you. I've gotten them into the Trump administration in several different places and have pretty good resonance, actually, by some people. And then something like this happens, you know? So what do you do at this point? This is where I like to retreat to one of my favorite phrases to say, you know, I'm just a scientist. And it's gonna take people with the political and diplomatic moxie of an Ambassador Matlock, you know, to figure out, what do you do in a case like this? It is just really disheartening. Okay, so let me turn to Russia. That's what I'm going to talk about today. And I've got sort of a peculiar history with Russia. You know, I mentioned yesterday that I got to Los Alamos 52 years ago. And so more or less for half of that, you know, I was on the side of making sure we take care of that adversary, the Soviet Union. And, you know, I helped to provide the technical knowledge as to make sure that we can deter, in other words, to field a nuclear arsenal that can deter the Soviet Union. And then the Soviet Union, you know, broke up, as Ambassador Matlock explained, you know, so vividly, it broke up. So then my life, you know, changed quite a bit. And so it's interesting to go literally from this confrontation era to something else. And so that's what I'm going to describe as to how we got there. So for me and Los Alamos and working with Russia, it all started with Reagan, Gorbachev. And particularly, Ambassador Matlock pointed out yesterday, the summit in October at Reykjavik. But I'm going to give you more of that history because what's so interesting, actually, in the nuclear world, the nuclear world has such a fascinating history. And I teach this in my classes. You know, I take them all the way from the upper left. That's Wilhelm Röntgen, who in Germany discovered X-rays. And that's what you see in the background is his wife's hand with a ring on her finger. So he took the first X-rays. And of course, he built his discovery on the back of the discoveries of many physicists in the 1800s. And then one goes from him down to Henri Becquerel in France, who discovered radioactivity, to Madame Curie, who, as probably most of you know, her maiden name was Sklodowska, and she was Polish. And so actually the element polonium was discovered by Madame Curie and was named after her, as was the element radium discovered by her. Curie, she got the name from Pierre Curie, a married physicist in France. And then he goes on to J.J. Thompson, who discovered the electron, Ernest Rutherford, and Frederick Soddy, who really tried to understand the inner workings of the atom, Niels Bohr, James Chadwick, he discovered the neutron. And then the picture in the middle of Leo Szilard, he was this incredibly paranoid Hungarian Jew. He was also a very, very strange human being. He never owned in a house his entire life. He just lived in hotels. He lived in hotels and he did a lot of thinking. And he left Hitler's Germany in 1933 because he was Jewish. He was working there. He went to London. And in 1934, shortly after Chadwick discovered the neutron, it is said that he liked to take long baths in the morning. So he would take a couple of hour baths and he'd think. And then he walked out and he stepped off the side of the curb. And the moment he stepped off, he had this idea and he wound up patenting the atomic bomb. And it turns out fission, which is on the upper right, Hahn and Strassmann in Germany, hadn't been discovered yet. So he had a different mechanism for how you'd get sort of a multiplication to have an atomic bomb. Now, where he got the name atomic bomb from is this incredible, interesting interplay of history, the arts, and science. Because the guy who coined the term the atomic bomb the first time was none other than H.G. Wells. H.G. Wells in 1914 wrote a book called The World Set Free. I recommend it for your reading. Essentially, he made up this thing called an atomic bomb because he was hanging around with Rutherford and Frederick Soddy, and they had discovered, you know, tried to think of what can you do with this thing one calls radioactivity. So he made up this idea, and in his book, he fights an atomic war. 1957, and he was a guy who was promoting world governments. And so he fought this war, and essentially the entire world, all the capitals of the world were wiped out, and that mankind didn't come to its senses until essentially everything was destroyed, and those who were left got together in the sort of the equivalent of Bellagio, Italy. He called it something else. So at any rate, and then Hahn and Strassmann discovered fission, the splitting of the nucleus, and that just went like wildfire through the whole scientific community. And within a year or so, all of the advanced countries essentially had the basic idea of how you would build an atomic bomb. And indeed, Leo Szilard again in the lower right, he meets with Einstein. Einstein had also left Germany. He got together with Einstein and he convinced Einstein to write this famous letter to Roosevelt, which was done in 1939, signed by Einstein and saying that we think an atomic bomb is possible. Anyway, I just give you some of this history. So this the history. This didn't happen in all this stuff in the United States. You know, we weren't the center of science in the first part of the 20th century. But then, as I said yesterday, you know, the world changed with Hiroshima and Nagasaki. There's a fantastic book by Richard Rhodes. It's called The Making of the Atomic Bomb, Pulitzer Prize winning book. And he said that mankind realized its own mortality with that devastation. I told you yesterday, one bomb, one city destroyed, one bomber. And then Robert Oppenheimer led the Manhattan Project. He was the first director of Los Alamos. Manhattan Project started in April of 1943. And this is what he said after the atomic bomb. He said, the atomic bomb made the prospect of future war unendurable. It led us up the last few steps to the mountaintop, and beyond, there's a different country. And in fact, if we look on from 1945 on, there was a different world. And again, Ambassador Matlock told you yesterday, the atomic bomb changed everything. It changed the world. And in fact, that was recognized very early on, and Oppenheimer served on a committee right after the war was ended to try to decide, what does one do now with this incredible power that one has, that one can destroy a city? And he participated in what was published as the H. Lilienthal Report. And I just have two phrases from here, which you need to remember because it carries through to this very day, and that is the incentive for other nations. Once you demonstrate that you can destroy an entire city with one bomb, the incentive for other nations to press for their own is overwhelming. And so if you think about, you know, North Korea, why would they develop a nuclear weapon? Well, the incentive is overwhelming. And then the other thing that you have to remember, that atomic energy for peaceful purposes and for bombs are in much of their course interchangeable and interdependent. That's what I was explaining yesterday, for example, with Iran. So they say, no, we're just doing this enrichment, you know, for nuclear reactors, to make electricity for our people. But it turns out that also gets you a big step towards the bomb. So for the bomb, you need other things, but for the most part, you have to understand those technologies are interrelated. And so controlling those technologies, so if you go after non-proliferation by wanting to control technologies, it is just difficult because you can claim civilian use for so much of it. And then that report led to the first interaction then, and I'll tell you a little bit more about, you know, what happened right during and after the war as far as Russia is concerned. But at this point, the conclusion from this was that one should control atomic energy internationally. And so Bernard Baruch, who was a very famous diplomat, he then went to the United Nations to present this Baruch plan to the United Nations. And here's the extent of it. And it's really quite amazing if you think back of June 1946, that we're going to extend the benefits of this civilian nuclear stuff to all nations, going to control atomic energy, you know, for peaceful purposes, for the elimination of nuclear armament. So at that time, the United States was the only country that had the bomb and had demonstrated the bomb. We're going to eliminate those national armaments. And then we're going to have effective safeguards you know, by way of inspections. Again, all this, 1946. So that's what they brought forth to the United Nations. However, they also then said, but in order to do this, you're going to have to agree, all countries have to agree to unrestricted inspections, and particularly inside of the Soviet Union. And as you might imagine, there's no way that Stalin was going to say yes, that you can come in whenever you want to into the Soviet Union. And so the arms race was on. So I wanted to give you sort of this background so that you get an understanding as to how and why the Soviet Union developed the bomb. So you have the immediate impact after the war with the explosion of two atomic bombs. You have the Baruch plan, and then you have the Soviet test. And they tested in August of 1949. And they had their first test, it's shown on the left, and the lake that you see behind, that's me standing in the middle, is at ground zero of their test site in a place that's called Semipalatinsk in Kazakhstan. And where you see that lake, that is the very ground zero, the depression that's still there from where the first test was actually detonated. The two people in the foreground on the left is Sergei Lukashenko, who actually is an ethnic Russian, went to work on Semipalatinsk, and after the Soviet Union broke up and Kazakhstan became an independent country, he stayed there, because he had a much better deal in Kazakhstan than he thought he'd have going back to Russia. On the far right is Khairat Kadyrjanov, who was the head of the National Nuclear Center, and next to him, my colleague Chaim Brown from Stanford. So it turns out, let me just fast forward a bit to 1992, when I first went to Russia and to their Los Alamos, the city of Sarov. And it was very interesting. They had a small little history place, and the man on the left was shown as one of their heroes. It turns out it's Klaus Fuchs, who we called the atomic spy. So Klaus Fuchs also came from Europe to England. And then he came with the British mission to the Manhattan Project at Los Alamos. And it turns out, because it was actually, you know, to give you the full history, it would take much longer. It was actually the Brits that finally convinced the Americans to build the bomb. But the Brits couldn't do it themselves because they were being bombed by the Germans. There was no way they could mount the industrial capacity to do so. Klaus Fuchs came with the British mission, and he was a Soviet sympathizer. And he thought, well, the Soviet Union is our ally in this war. How come we're not sharing these atomic secrets? So he did. He was, of course, considered a hero over there. On the right is Yuli Borisovich Khariton. He's the guy we call their Oppenheimer. So he was in charge of the developing the bomb. Just to show how central European physics was, it turns out Khariton was a student of Sir Ernest Rutherford at Cambridge, 1926 to 1928. He almost overlapped. He only missed by 6 months being there at the same time that J. Robert Oppenheimer was at Cambridge. So these guys were all there at the great schools of European science, particularly European physics. So Fuchs did manage to get him the blueprints of the bomb, and here's Khariton sitting in front of their first device, which was tested there at Semipalatinsk. And it's in essence a carbon copy of the device U.S. tested at the test shot called Trinity, and then the one dropped in Nagasaki. In other words, it's a plutonium bomb. And so I was there on February 23rd, 1992. I'll show you a little bit, a photo of the arrival. And then they took us to the guest house. And in the guest house, Khariton talked about the Soviet nuclear program, how it got started. And of course, you know, I'd heard the stories through our intel agencies as to what we think was there, but he told it in more detail than I've ever heard it. And so he explained, yes, indeed, Fuchs, you know, gave us the blueprints. But then the most interesting aspect, and it really sort of signifies the entire Soviet program, he said, we didn't just want to copy that. We didn't want to make a bomb. We wanted to build a program. We wanted to build a program. So he said there were only three of us who ever saw any of those blueprints. And all those other hundreds of thousands of people who were working there on the bomb, they didn't know that. So he said, only we had the blueprints. And so they went ahead. We wanted them to go ahead and develop and build the bomb. He said, every now and then we had to go ahead and look in the safe, you know, to say, oh, no, no, you know, next morning, no, that's not the what you want to do. You'd like to try something else. But, and then, you know, we tested this lookalike. And I said, well, you know, that's interesting. But he said, you know, yes, we tested that. But by the time we tested that, we already had a design that was half of the size of that and twice as powerful. And I said, well, with all due respect, Professor Hariton, so why didn't you test yours? And he said, well, you've heard of Lavrenti Beria, haven't you? And I said, well, yes, I have. And he says, well, he was running the program, and he said, because we knew yours worked and we wanted to live. And so, yes, we tested yours, but we were well on our way. And they were. And so still, I was still struggling, you know, with this issue. How can you get people like Andrei Sakharov, you know, shown on the left, and Yuli Borisovich Hariton, when I met him, an incredible gentleman. I mean, not just a fantastic scientist, but a true gentleman. How can people, and quite liberal thinking, how can people like that work for, you know, a brutal dictator like Stalin? And so think again a little bit like North Korea. And so here are the responses. So Sakharov, in his memoir, I never met him personally, said, I regard myself as a soldier in this new scientific war. Then you can read that in the end, you know, after a devastating war, to make the country strong enough to ensure peace. That's why I worked on the bomb. Hariton gave the speech that Ambassador Matlack gave yesterday. And he said, monopolies are no good, including for the monopolist. He said, it was crucial not for the U.S. to have a monopoly on the bomb. It was crucial for the world that the U.S. would not have that monopoly. So that's why he worked on the bomb. So Soviets test the bomb in 1949. The arms race was on. And Eisenhower, of course, who was the supreme commander of American forces, Allied forces in Europe, when he became president, the bomb really bothered him. And by that time, one had the initial inklings already that we actually know how to build a hydrogen bomb. And by the way, Edward Teller, who was at Los Alamos working on the bomb, and for the most part, Edward Teller had very little contribution to the atomic fission devices in the bomb, because he was already totally he was committed and convinced that one can make a hydrogen bomb, what he called the super. And so he was working on the super, and basically Oppenheimer told him, just go in a corner, you work on the super, don't bother the other guys, we got to build this bomb. And then he stayed with it, and actually he was unhappy with Los Alamos, because the second director of Los Alamos, Norris Bradbury, he felt was not doing enough to develop the hydrogen bomb. And Robert Oppenheimer, who had gone to Princeton after his turn in the Manhattan Project in Los Alamos, was also not convinced that the hydrogen bomb was a good idea. But then it turns out Teller and a Polish mathematician who came to the United States by the name of Stanislaw Ulam, they finally developed a concept that I showed you yesterday. So you set off the fission bomb, and you have the X-rays that are generated by a fish bomb sort of come around and squeeze and make the secondary, as it's called, the deuterium-tritium part, fuse, and then go ahead and increase the yield, you know, by a factor of 1,000 or so. And that really concerned Eisenhower, as he knew those developments were going on. By the way, Teller then went on to actually establish a competitor to Los Alamos. And that's how we got Lawrence Livermore at National Laboratory. He had Ernest Lawrence, who was at Berkeley. And Ernest Lawrence was also, you know, very, very conservative guy, very much worried about the Soviet Union. And so Lawrence and Teller were the two prime movers to establish Lawrence Livermore Laboratory as a competitor to Los Alamos Laboratory. And I take my students every spring. Elliot was there. He's actually my assistant this year, but he was there with me with the students. I take him to Livermore. And Bruce Tarter, who was one of my colleagues and counterparts at Livermore, gives the history of Livermore. And it's really fascinating, where he says, okay, so they got these 100 people together, 100 scientists and engineers, to start Livermore. And actually, Herb York, who eventually wound up to be chancellor at UC San Diego, was there as one of the young men. He became the first director. He was 32 years old. The instructions to their people, to the 100 people, you go ahead and you design a bomb, just don't do it like Los Alamos. Any way you want to do it, just don't do it like Los Alamos, to make sure there's some competition. And indeed, then Livermore was off and running. All of these things were in 1952, they were formed. Eisenhower was worried, and he proposed this Adams for Peace. In essence, we'll share our secrets with you to develop the peaceful parts of the atom if you forswear building a bomb. And if you look at the words, you look at that speech, it is a beautiful speech, really beautiful speech. You know, he wanted to solve the fearful atomic dilemma, and then particularly in which the miraculous inventiveness of man shall not be dedicated to his death, but consecrated to his life. Okay, so then just quickly, in spite of that, here's what happened in terms of the first five nations that went nuclear, going nuclear meaning displaying it and establishing that with a nuclear test. United States, Soviet Union, UK, it's actually very interesting, although the Brits pushed the United States to building the bomb, they were here in the United States with us working on the bomb, and then we cut them off. We sent them home and said, you shouldn't be doing this. You know, you shouldn't be building a bomb. We cut them off. But of course, they knew the whole thing. They just had to build the industrial capacity. They did, and then tested the first bomb in 52 against our wishes. By 58, we got back together and signed the first US-UK atomic energy agreement, and have been essentially partners in this business ever since. So with the UK, we actually share atomic secrets. The French, again, much to our dismay, went ahead and built the bomb. And of course they did. They had the Curies, and they had many others, scientists. They knew all stuff nuclear, and particularly with Charles de Gaulle in charge, and then particularly after the Suez crisis. Where the French felt the U.S. deserted them, they decided they're going to go ahead and demonstrate it. And then the Chinese, in a very interesting history, Mao at first said the nuclear bomb is just a paper tiger, we don't need it. But then he decided that indeed he may need it, and he got help from the Soviets. And then he got into a major disagreement with Nikita Khrushchev, and the Soviets tried to pull all of their things back, and China went on and built their own bomb. So I just wanted you to have that as a background so you understand. These are also, of course, eventually the P5, you know, from permanent five of the National Security Council. So the arms race was on. So one goes from Soviet test to fusion to Eisenhower, and then you might imagine Once the countries developed long-range bombers to have a better capacity to deliver that upped the ante. And then once they developed ICBMs, you know, then you're talking about half an hour of being able to deliver a weapon. We're testing the weapons, unlike the North Korea. You know, if you say, well, the North Korea do nothing but provocations, well, thank God they're not testing one in the atmosphere. But we tested them in the atmosphere, and so did the Soviets. And people like Sakharov were very, very concerned about the health effects of radiation. And he managed, and our scientists managed to talk our governments into a nuclear testing moratorium. 1958 to 1961, the Soviets broke out of that in 1961, and then they actually wound up testing one that I'll show you in a little bit, of a huge, huge, largest hydrogen bomb ever tested. And then one had spy planes and spy satellites to give you an idea what's there, the arms race, all the technical innovations to be able to make a bomb smaller and smaller, to be able to put multiple warheads, you know, on a single rocket, and independently target them. It was called MIRV. And then our countries also actually got the sense, hey, you know, this is getting out of hand. And so they really got into arms control, doing Soviet days yet. And so even though they were, you know, our enemies and we were their enemies, we did have to work together. And actually through some of the very dark days of the Cold War, actually Gromyko said later on sometime, you know, this whole arms control and non-proliferation arena, it was sort of the silver thread or the silk thread that kept us together. And so it was very important. And then President Reagan actually thought, look, let's change this from, you know, what was called MAD, mutual assured destruction, that we can make sure to wipe everything that you have of value off the face of the earth, and therefore you're not going to attack us. And President Reagan said, look, that's really quite immoral. Why don't we just defend ourselves and do anti-ballistic missile? So that's what he proposed in 1983. So that's what the U.S. Nuclear missile force looks like, nuclear force looks like. It's called the Triad. You launch, in the middle you launch missiles from land. The left, you launch them from submarines, and on the right, you deliver bombs with a bomber. So that's the triad. And the Soviets had essentially the same capabilities. We had a true standoff. So we went through all of that, and you know, one of the key moments was indeed the Cuban Missile Crisis. But before the Cuban Missile Crisis, what already heated things up, I told you, there was this more testing moratorium, and then the Soviets broke out. And as you see here, on October 30th of 1961, they tested this thing called the Tsar Bomba. We call it the Tsar Bomba. And I told you yesterday that it was 50 megatons, actually designed to be 100 megatons. But Sakharov, he told Khrushchev, we should not test this bomb. Khrushchev essentially said, you stick to your science, I'll make the political decisions. But he managed to talk him into testing at half yield. And the way you do that, you just put some dummy materials in with the plutonium and the highly enriched uranium. And you know, if you'd made the rest highly enriched uranium, you would have gotten twice the yield. And they dropped this out of a bomber up in Novaya Zemlya above the Arctic Circle. And one of the funny stories, on top of that mushroom cloud, you see one of the designers of that bomb, and that's Yuri Trutnev. And I'm there with Yuri Trutnev in front of the bomb in the museum in Sarov. And we had dinner at Yuri's house, and over pickled mushrooms. He was presumed to be the best mushroom picker in all of Sarov. And for the Russians, you know, that's really important. Over the pickled mushrooms, I said to Yuri, look, my colleague right next to me, Jim Taves, who was with me, he has on his view graphs that this bomb produced 57 megatons. And from everything I read, I thought it was 50 megatons. So I said, Yuri, you're one of the designers with Andrei Sakharov. What was it? Was it 50 or was it 57? Yuri looks at me and he says, Sig, At that level, it doesn't matter. So he never answered because it doesn't matter. So 100 megaton bomb, again, as I said yesterday, 5,000 Nagasakis, just, Trutnev said, of course, it didn't have any military utility. But we were sending you guys a message. And then, of course, the message also in the Cuban Missile Crisis. And there's one, there are lots of books, of course, on the Cuban Missile Crisis. Michael Dobbs wrote a very interesting one, this 1 Minute to Midnight, of how close we came to a potential confrontation and potential nuclear exchange. Okay, so again, and so putting all of this into the proper, oh, I do have this little pointer, very good. So Eisenhower gave a speech down here. These are the number of warheads or bombs, strategic, meaning the ability to reach long range. Eisenhower was concerned down here when the Soviets had almost nothing and we had, you know, a few hundred. And, you know, arms race took off from here. Soviets were catching up. The Americans in the blue, we kept increasing at a much faster pace. And then around 1967 or so, we actually stopped increasing the number in our stockpile. But it wasn't because we were getting soft. It's just because our delivery systems got so much more accurate. We didn't need all those bombs. One of the reasons you needed those bombs, if you're not sure where the bomb's going to land, you know, by miles, you just put more of them out there. When the delivery systems became so accurate, then you didn't need them. And so we just kept on increasing the capability of our arsenal through improvements in delivery systems, and then make sure the warheads fit those delivery systems. The Soviets kept building. Here's the Cuban Missile Crisis. Here's the Non-Proliferation Treaty in 1970. As you can see, that still did not stop the buildup between our two countries. Even though we were doing arms control during those days, sort of in the 70s and early 80s, the SALT treaties, Strategic Arms Limitation Treaties. And this whole thing, this accumulative, that is both Soviet and American, didn't turn around until the Gorbachev years and Gorbachev-Reagan years. And also, I wanted to show you this, just to put in perspective, what about all these other countries? UK, France, and China, they're down here, they're in the noise. They're in the noise. So these are the two big guys here, United States and Russia. And the numbers, you know, as you look at it today, you must say it doesn't make much sense. I mean, why in the world did the Soviets need almost 40,000 and we needed 30,000? So then again, to get to Reagan, so maybe a little bit, you know, like when President George W. Bush gave his speech of the axis of evil, you know, I couldn't help but to think back at the speech of the evil empire. And this was at, shown here, the 41st Annual Convention, National Association of Evangelists. It was down in Orlando, Florida. And that's where he gave this speech on the evil empire. He also, just a couple of weeks later, he announced this Star Wars, a strategic defense initiative, and that is that he wants to change the course of human history, to defend ourselves, not to threaten ourselves with destruction. But then that eventually, you know, led into Gorbachev and Reykjavik. But here are just some of the rest of the milestones in U.S. And Soviet nuclear relations, you know, from Reykjavik, the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty to ban certain types of missiles and capabilities of certain range, the Threshold Test Ban Treaty, which was eventually signed, I'll come back to that, in 1990. And then finally, Reagan and Gorbachev started talking about reducing, arms reduction, not just limitations. George H.W. Bush, major initiatives with Gorbachev, and I'll go through these in a bit more, but I just wanted to give you the overall sense. So then to get to Reykjavik, this is, as was discussed yesterday, that's where Gorbachev and Reagan came close to eliminating nuclear weapons, but Reagan insisted that we would keep the Strategic Defense Initiative, and Gorbachev just couldn't swallow that. So they walked away from that, but as a result, we did get the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaties, and then more importantly, we got something that actually got our scientists together and that wound up being responsible for me working with the Soviets and then the Russians. So just to put that in perspective, now this was October of 1986. So by whatever reason, I wound up being director of Los Alamos in January 15th of 1986. You know, I was all of 42 years old, taking over this laboratory of 10,000 people, and I had been at Los Alamos for the most part since 65, although I went back to get a PhD at Case in Cleveland. I worked for General Motors for 3 years. I spent the rest of the time at Los Alamos being a scientist, having a great time, and then sort of winding up in this position of directorship. And so during my first year, first of all, right at the end of 85, that was the end of the Reagan defense buildup and the budget buildup. And it was the first sequestration called Graham Rudman Hollings that hit us. And so I became director, budget had been going up, and all of a sudden, hey, this is going to be a different world. 13 days after I became director, the Challenger shuttle blew up. Killed 7 astronauts. A reminder that high-tech systems sometimes fail. And then actually 2 weeks and 2 months after I became director, FBI came to see me. I've had lots of FBI stories lately, so I have my own FBI story. Someday I'll write this up. But FBI came to see me and they said, you have a spy in your design, weapon design division. And, you know, here I am, 43 years old, I'm a scientist type. I said, get him out of here! And they said, no, we can't do that. We gotta catch this guy. 12 years of directorship, they were watching this guy. I couldn't get him out of Los Alamos. His name was Wan Ho Lee. There's the story that actually Dan Stober and Ian Hoffman wrote, and it's about the best book on Wan Ho Lee. The worst book is the one by himself, where he calls himself a convenient enemy, that he was made by the government a convenient enemy. I don't want to get into the whole story, but the bottom line of Wan Ho Lee, he stole our secrets blind. Very, very bad situation. What's not clear that he ever gave those secrets to anyone, whether he was actually a spy or not, but what he did was unconscionable. And then in April, not only high-tech systems, but nuclear systems, Chernobyl blew up. And the response, as you remember, Ambassador Matlock, was Soviet-like. First nothing, then denial, and they waited a long time, and that actually caused some of the major health-related problems. And then in 86, Reagan and Gorbachev got together, already following up the 1985 and a couple of their other get-togethers. So I wanted to show you this. So this is what I started with. And so here I am at my first news conference. Don't I look prepared for this? So this was only the beginning of it all. So that was my first year as director of Los Alamos. So somebody finally told me I had to get rid of those glasses. And I said, what do you mean? I mean, they're the photochromic. You know, they turn dark when I go outside, so I have to get separate sunglasses. They said, no, you can't. You look like a gangster, you know. So, well, anyway, that was the beginning. I was there for 12 years. And then all these other things happened, you know, from 1986 on. Actually, on the upper left is my colleague Don Eilers, holding the flag of New Mexico over the Atomic Lake out in Semipalatinsk, because we wind up getting out there. The Berlin Wall, you know, coming down in the middle, Boris Yeltsin on the T-72 tank, Gorbachev, Yeltsin, President Bush, the end of testing, last test at the U.S. was Los Alamos test, 23rd September 1992. World changed. So I'd mentioned this threshold test ban treaty, the TTBT. So this was a treaty that was signed in 1974. And much like the CTBT, Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, it wasn't ratified because we didn't trust the Soviets and they didn't trust us. But since Anna came back in, I want to make sure particularly that she saw this one photograph, because I know she would appreciate it. So I was showing all the things that happened during my first year, and I was showing how prepared I was.
Very impressed.
Okay, so as a result of Reagan and Gorbachev getting together in Reykjavik, they said, look, why don't we do something to go ahead and be able to ratify that treaty? And our scientists had been working on methods of doing on-site verification, in addition to a lot of the sort of non-governmental community had said, look, we can measure these things off-site, because if you do, you know, as I said yesterday, if you go ahead and set off a nuclear bomb underground, you shake the ground and then you pick up the seismic signals. But there were enough people who didn't trust those. So we were going to do this experiment. And the experiment, 1988, Soviets come, take their technical team, come on our test site. So when I was told, you got to let the Soviets on the test, I said, what do you mean? You know, this it's one of our most secret places. And they said, no, we want you to do that. So okay, so we let the Soviet team in, and they lived there for months. We did the test. It was called Kearsarge, 1988, August 17th. And then a little less than a month later, our folks were over at Semipalatinsk, and we did similar measurements. And that was for us the breakthrough, because all of a sudden, for the first time, U.S. and Soviet scientists had worked together, even during the Cold War, you know, pursuing ideas of basic science together. But we had never met their weapons lab people, and we did here. And in fact, this is one of the shots of the control room. And I was there as director of Los Alamos, because it was a Los Alamos device, the control room at the Nevada test site, August 17th. And actually, it turns out right over here is Ambassador Polonik and our Ambassador Paul Robinson sitting next to each other. We were waiting. Now, you can imagine, this was probably the day of my life that I was the most apprehensive. I think I could say nervous. And the reason for that, you know, just imagine, here we are, we've got one of our devices downhole. We're going to do this test. It's supposed to be close to 150 kilotons, because that was the threshold test ban limit. So we were told, get a device that's close to 150 kilotons. But of course, don't go over, because the Soviets are there measuring. And so I said, okay, guys, you know, we've got this figured out. It's going to be less than 150 kilotons or close. My technical people said, yeah, no problem. But then the other thought as we were sitting here, suppose we pushed a button and nothing happens. Nothing happens. What does that do to the American deterrent when our bomb doesn't work? It turns out it went off. It was close to 150 kilotons. Ambassador Paul Robinson, Polnick, went to Geneva. They did negotiations, and we were off and running. Here's just another shot of the test site. In the meantime, the world was changing dramatically. You know, from actually way in the lower left, already starting in Poland, the Solidarity movement. But then the Berlin Wall on the upper side, and then the human chain across the Baltics in 1989. Everything was changing. And then Ambassador Matlock already set me up beautifully. The attempted coup in days of August 1821, 1991, were the hardliners on the upper right here. Put Gorbachev under house arrest and apparently took away the nuclear suitcase, the launch codes. Boris Yeltsin stood up and helped essentially to push things back in Moscow, bring Gorbachev back. And here's Gorbachev with his wife Raisa coming back. But even if you look carefully at him, he's not a happy man. It was the end of the line for Gorbachev and for the Soviet Union. However, what was quite amazing, and there are lots of studies of this, and I find them very, very interesting, of that really energized the American community to say, my God, you've got all of these nuclear weapons, materials, and people, and everything out there, and they just lost control. What if this country comes apart? And President George H.W. Bush, who I think does not get enough credit, he took these nuclear initiatives, steps, to turn down the heat, not to put the pressure on. He could have put the pressure on to see whether he can't just make everything collapse. Instead, he took the pressure off. He took the heat off so that they would be able to do similar steps. And there's this fantastic phone call, September 27th, it's now declassified, George Washington University, of where Bush calls up Gorbachev and he says, "Hello, Mikhail." And he goes and explains what he's going to do in his presidential initiatives. And then he says, you know, and I would appreciate, you know, if I would get some reciprocal action from you. And Gorbachev says, in most Russian terms, Gorbachev says, well, I agree in principle. Now, how many times have you heard where the Russians said, in principle, that's okay? But he'd have to think about it. October 5th, he gave his speech, and he did all of those things because George H.W. Bush took the pressure off. And then, and I didn't put this on here just for you, Bill, I've shown it in other places, the NGO community, which quite frankly, when I was at Los Alamos, I was direct, I sort of felt them, they were a pain, you know, and you know where, because they just kept pushing in so many ways and angles. And then I really got to appreciate, and as I was writing the book, which I'll say a little bit more about later, then I went back and I dug through a lot of the literature and I just found as to how incredible that community was in pushing us in a direction. Well, I was still director at Los Alamos, worried mostly about Soviet responses. And so on upper left is Sidney Drell. Tom Cochran, who was in with the NRDC, what he did was just remarkable with the Soviets. He's actually the guy who organized the seismic measurements off-site. Tom Neff, he's the guy who thought of the idea of the HU-LEU deal, and that is to actually take 500 metric tons of highly enriched uranium from Russia, have them converted to low enriched, as I was explaining yesterday, then we bought it. And for the last 10 to 15 years, one out of 10 of every one of these light bulbs, I actually powered by former Russian nuclear materials. One out of 10, because we bought it. Nuclear electricity makes up about 20% of US electricity, and that Russian fuel made up for half of that. So that's what's called, you know, megatons to megawatts. Bill Potter, many of you know the story. He was there, not only with the Russians, but also with Kazakhstan. Actually, Bill and his students are there everywhere I go in the world. You know, there's somebody, oh yes, I was one of the people at Monterey. Yevgeny Velikov on the lower left, he was the principal guy on the Russian side, academician. John Holden, who was at that time at Harvard, and he was President Obama's science advisor. Frank von Hippel, one of the all-time scientists who's just spent a good part of his life doing this. And then David Hamburg, who very few people know, but he was head of the Carnegie Corporation at the time. Of course, he was lots of other things before. And he funded, so if you think about what Carnegie has done, what they do today, they funded the activity which led to this, the Cooperative Threat Reduction Program. And they funded the activity of a report at Harvard, that the guy on the upper left, Ash Carter, who at that time was still quite a young man, he with his colleagues, Carter, Campbell, Miller, and Zagret, they published this report called Soviet Nuclear Fission. In other words, Soviet Union is going to come apart, and when it comes apart, what's going to happen? And they said, look, we have to have a cooperative program with the Soviets when that happens. And indeed, it was then, this is Bill Perry, who was at Stanford at the time, also an NGO, an academic. This is David Hamburg, sponsoring all of that. John Steinbruner, who is now at Brookings. And they basically provided the key ideas and the justification for what then became the Nunn-Lugar Cooperative Threat Reduction Program. And those are the two guys you see below. Then, of course, again, I don't have to go through this, on December 25th, that was the official dissolution. But of course, it had been proceeding for some time. Okay, so that's module one. Let me stop and at least see if you have any questions about this. Then we'll take a short break and we'll get on with module two. Yes?
Can you